Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. There are many nouns you could choose to describe parenting. A joy, a struggle, a challenge, an art, a skill, a journey. But how about a science? That was the question pondered at a gathering in Concord this week, the latest in the city's Science Cafe series, a monthly conversation event that covers topics from Lyme disease to Bitcoin to electric cars. But while it's easy to see how these subjects would fit into a science and tech discussion, what about parenting? Is there really science behind child rearing? And if so, how reliable is it? How valid are all those books that promise you parenting perfection? That's what we're asking today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We have two guests for the hour. KJ Dell'Antonia is here, writer and author of a parenting blog, former lead editor and writer for the Motherload blog at the New York Times. KJ is also the author of the forthcoming book, How to Be a Happier Parent. And KJ, it's great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Jessica Leahy, writer for many publications, including the New York Times and the Atlantic. She's also the author of The Gift of Failure, a best-selling book about the benefits of allowing children to make mistakes. And she's a teacher in Vermont. And Jessica, a big welcome to you, too. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, both of you, when I think of science, I think of studies that you can measure, putting data in my little blue science lab book, reporting on the effects of adding A plus B. Jessica, to you first, what's science-y about raising kids?
The science behind raising kids really has to do more with, you know, the research on sleep and how beneficial sleep is, or how learning works. So we sort of extrapolate parenting research from other areas, from areas such as, you know, education or business or all these other areas. And then there is a sort of a core group of researchers looking at what works and what doesn't work for how we motivate kids and how we get kids to do the things we need them to do in order for them to grow up to be, you know, strong and resilient adults.
So you're pulling from the science of other disciplines and kind of mashing it all together to call it the science of parenting?
Often. I mean, it's really hard to do sort of double-blind experiments on kids. You know, that's not exactly something that's easy to get permission for. So often what we're looking at is what motivates people in other industry, in other areas, or what we notice about in the social science about sort of how people interact with, for example, social media, that kind of thing. And then sort of extrapolate that back to, you know, how parenting should function, how it should work in order to get the best results out of kids.
Yeah. So inputs and outputs, real easy. Thank you for making it sound like an experiment. What do you think, KJ? Is there anything science-y about child rearing?
Well, when you're, as a parent, when you've got a question and you want to turn to research or to others for an answer, you have a couple of possibilities. If you have a question about vaccines or something along those lines, there is data. There is actual scientific research, double-blind study data about stuff like that. Then we get more into questions like, you know, what's my best disciplinary approach? How can I best interact with my arguing siblings? And there we get... We tend to see like a couple of different kinds of research, and it's really important to look. If you're going to read an article or even a research study about how things are done, you want to look at how that research was gathered. So sometimes you'll see, you know, it's anecdotal. It's somebody's experience about how they've done something well, and that can still be very helpful to you. Sometimes you'll see actual researchers saying, children are watching this much television a day, or parents who, when their siblings argue, respond by intervening, have more success, or something along those lines. And then you really want to ask yourself, wait, who's telling you that those kids are watching that much screen time a day? Because I'll tell you that if parents are reporting how much time their children are watching or spending on screens, it's probably low. There's data to suggest that.
In other words, there's a data problem right there.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. And then when it comes to like the sibling interactions, you actually get some research where they've brought, you know, siblings or parents, they've either gone to the homes and watched them in an organized group. That's much more informative, again, than parents talking about either what they did or what you often get is parents talking about what they would do or you know, their perfect image. So there's science out there. There's research. There's some interesting stuff. But it's really important to look at where the suggestions are coming from.
Well, and I hear you. When it comes to health stuff, then sure, you can say, you know, here's the inputs, here's the outputs, here's the measurement. Science Cafe host Dave Brooks of the Concord Monitor says in his article on this, and this follows up with what you said, Jessica, that the problem is you can't do long-term double-blind studies on different parenting styles. So what is meaningful, Jessica? Kind of following up on Dave's point, but also KJ's point, you have to kind of look at what's meaningful, what's valid, and what isn't.
Well, first of all, one of the things you can look at is to see who's reporting the information. And KJ touched on this a little bit. But often what they'll just do is they'll ask parents to reflect on their own parenting practices. And that's called self-reporting. And self-reporting is notoriously slippery, right? Because we tend to remember certain things or underestimate, as KJ said, the screen time for our kids. Or, you know, that's really difficult to sort of keep an accurate eye to. And so it's really important to think about, you know, who are they asking and how are they asking it? And the unfortunate reality also is that with a lot of this research, and sometimes you do have to put little air quotes around that, that the way the questions are being asked are loaded. And so KJ and I spend a lot of time, if we're going to do, for example, journalism on, oh, there's this new study showing that if you restrict your kids' viewing time to 1 hour a day, that they're going to be much more likely to get into an Ivy League school. Well, there's so many confounders there. Like, you know, did they only ask rich kids, rich families? Did they only ask poor families? Did they only ask, you know, educated families? It's really dicey to sort of, you have to become a really savvy consumer. And I think it's worth repeating that that's one of the most important things we can do as parents is say, look, what's the agenda of the person offering this information to us and how did they gather the information?
And how do you sort through all that information? It seems, KJ, there is so much information. I mean, there's always been shelves and shelves and shelves of books at the bookstore, but now you have shelves and shelves and shelves endlessly on Amazon, never mind all the blogs and, you know, writing on the internet, social media. How do you and Jessica just sort through it all?
Well, I think we'd both agree that we never write about or use, you know, a research study or something along those lines unless we've actually read it. We don't read the snippet that's available for free and sort of go from there, because it's really important to know how the data was collected and what was done to draw those conclusions. And as Jess said, what conclusions the people might have been looking for. So that's a big piece of it. And then we look to, you know, who the writer is and what their history is. You know, a journalist with a deep history in traditional media typically is going to do the same thing that we do. So you can have some faith in what they're saying. A parent, I mean, I love parenting memoirs. I take a lot from them. And a lot of my own research tends to be of the anecdotal. I asked, you know, a couple thousand people on Facebook and I collected the answers and I wrapped them up. And that's really fun. You just look at that a little differently than you do when you have, like, you know, trained people trying to watch interactions.
It's what you described first on Facebook is a survey. It's not science.
Right. And you got to be careful with surveys. And now we're getting, you can get really interesting with surveys. But lots of the surveys that you will see reported online are done by people who are opting in, who have internet connections, who are getting paid a small amount to participate in them. So that's, you know, that's a particular audience. They're rarely reflective of the national population in terms of demographics. If someone wants them to be. I did a large survey for my book, How to Be a Happier Parent, and it was great. And I worked with a researcher from Fordham University in order to do it, and we made it. You know, we worked so that it would be nationally representative, and that was hard, and that was challenging, and it was hard to get all of those different voices of income and background. So when you see a survey that's from, like, Disney Travel International, they probably didn't do that. And that doesn't mean that you can't then use that to say, you know, 50% of parents tell Disney Travel International that they need a vacation after their vacation. But you just want to, you know, you want to be aware of what it is you're saying.
Well, so what you're doing is so careful. And yeah. Both of you have described studies that are of high quality science, if we can call it that, that is isn't junk science. But it seems like, KJ, just listening to you, there is a lot of sort of junk science, which is really more just parenting opinion out there.
Yeah. Or
and nothing wrong with opinion, but it's not science.
No. That kind of stuff invites a conversation. I mean, the conversation could be about, well, what kind of 50% of parents say that thing? Or the conversation could be about, how did they find those parents? Or it could just be about, well, that's not my experience. Why do I feel differently than those parents? It's still fun. It's still useful. It's not necessarily something to base an action on.
It's media literacy. There's a lot of talk about that these days.
Research literacy.
I also think it's interesting. One of the things we have to talk about is sort of how the media works these days is that many journalists get these little data dumps in the morning of the new studies that are coming out. And there are these little prepackaged sort of press releases that come from whatever institution is putting the research out. And you know, I would never write an article based on just this little press release put out by the university. You have to dig deeper and you have to look and you have to figure out, you know, all of the reasons that maybe the data is not great. I'm really lucky in that I'm married to a statistician, so I often hand things to him and say, tell me what's wrong with this study. And he comes back with a list of 14 things that are wrong with the study. But the problem is that there's such a need for content that inevitably what happens is that, you know, someone will say, there's a new study showing that if you just feed your kid two oranges a day, they're building their brain at a much higher rate than kids who eat kumquats. And, you know, it's an interesting conversation, but I think it's really important to understand the limitations of these sort of new study released this morning means that XYZ, I'm going to say, well, I know they didn't talk to that researcher because it just came out this morning in the data dump in their email. And do I want to extract? And I do this a lot with education data. I wrote an article about how to read education data without jumping to conclusions, because that's what tends to happen a lot is we'll see a study about how, you know, we shouldn't have a lot of posters up on the wall in kindergarten because it distracts kids from the learning. And then you find out, and then people are saying, great, well, we should take everything off the walls of every single school because that's distracting and kids will do better. Well, no, that's not what that study said. That study said that in this one kindergarten, they did this one very specific thing. So let's not, you know, jump to conclusions and run with it. And I think the same thing needs to happen with parents. You know, you get up in the morning and you see someone's posted on their Facebook feed that I just read this study showing that cranberries are the answer to everything. Maybe
put out by the cranberry board.
Exactly. But yeah. And maybe we need to be a little bit more credulous about that sort of thing.
So here's the why. And KJ, I'll turn to you first. Why are parents, especially maybe new parents, so susceptible to this? I mean, we all know that eating oranges isn't going to, you know, boost our brain more than kumquats or whatever. I love that example. And yet parents, especially, again, new parents, are kind of vulnerable to that messaging.
I think new parents and current parents and modern parents, we feel like life is different and the world has changed, and we're definitely right to some extent. So we look back on the way that we were raised and we feel like, oh, you know, either there's something I didn't like about that or there's something about that that just doesn't, you know, I can't do it that way. I can't stay home like my mother did, or we just don't live in the same place. And now I feel lost. I feel like there's no consensus. And previous generations of parents tended to be more able to build on their own parents because while life was changing and evolving, it wasn't changing and evolving as much. People didn't move around as much. The differences, while often huge, they weren't as significant. And I think that parents are really looking for an answer, whereas in previous days, there was sort of more of an agreement about what it was people were supposed to do.
And maybe there was an aunt close by or a grandmother close by or a circle of, you know, older women who were there to support you or older men or whatever.
Right.
Traditionally, we've had one expert to look to, whether that's the physician or the grandmother. And, you know,
or Dr. Spock with that one book.
Exactly. And, you know, the history of American parenting really ebbs and flows depending on who culture thinks we should be listening to. You know, there's a time when everyone listened to the grandmother. And then there was a period of time where doctors said, don't listen to the grandmother. That's the worst thing you could do. Listen to us. Parenting is all a science. We need to tell you exactly how much food your child should have at what interval. And then we get the you trust yourself, you know more than you think, Dr. Spock. And then suddenly we're allowed to rely on ourselves. And relying on ourselves is great, and feeling empowered as parents is great. But that also means that there's so much opportunity to second guess ourselves.
Well, especially if you've never done it before.
Exactly. And the idea that we're supposed to have a baby and suddenly understand everything about, you know, and we're supposed to trust ourselves and that we know more than we think, that's fantastic. But I don't know that I came home from the hospital suddenly with all this new understanding about what was best for my baby.
You didn't get that, like, download implant in your head? Oh, sorry.
Okay, I put the baby in the car seat wrong. And as I was leaving the hospital, a nurse said, you can't leave the hospital with the baby in the car seat like that. So this shows you the depths of my experience. I want to invite our listeners to join us. We're talking about the science of parenting. And our guests say, yes, there is a science to it, although it's complicated. Let's hear from you. The number here in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. We're following up on a Science Cafe discussion in Concord this week on the science of parenting. Science Cafe is hosted by Dave Brooks of Granite Geek and the Concord Monitor. We've got links to that on our website. You can join us now as well with a question or comment. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So there has been a lot of science, both of you, on the brain in recent years. And we've done a ton of shows on all the advances in neuroscience. We know a lot more than we used to about how the young brain develops. Jessica, maybe to you first. How does that inform the work that you do? And then maybe the way you raise your own kids, that we do know a lot more now about the young brain.
Well, my eye is always to education / parenting. So, you know, I love the fact that my job is to look into research on the brain and how it informs learning, and then hopefully, you know, make that applicable to my own children as well. So I happen to love, for example, the work of Mary Helen Immordino Yang. She's at University of Southern California, and she puts kids in fMRIs. And she watches their brains
An fMRI?
Oh, sorry, a functional MRI. So she can, in real time, look at their brain to see what's lighting up when she, for example, and I can't believe there had to be a study on this, you put kids in this MRI tube and you look at their brain while they're learning something they care about and something they don't care about.
Okay, there's a duh factor there. I could have told you that without the fMRI.
Exactly. But the interesting information about that for education is you can say, well, then it's going to be really, really important if we want kids to learn durably and well that we need to make learning relevant for them. And that I can take that to my classroom, and then I can also use that in my own parenting. If a kid comes home and says, you know, I hate math class. You can then say, okay, well, I know from the research that kids are going to learn stuff better when it's relevant to them. So how can I make math, learning math relevant for my kids so that he'll care more? Because we care, we learn stuff better when we care about it. So just using these principles, you know, I love the fact that I can sort of straddle the two worlds of education and parenting and write about both because they're inextricably linked to each other.
Well, KJ, after a short break, I'll also ask you about neuroscience. Big advances there and how you apply that in your work. And we'll start taking your questions and comments. Do you think there is a science to parenting? If so, what does it look like? If not, how would you describe it? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More on the science of parenting in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Month after month, an extraordinary group of listeners are making a big difference for NHPR. Sustaining members provide reliable support that keeps NHPR strong and independent, ensuring everyone in the state has access to outstanding journalism. Thank you, sustainers, who make NHPR possible. Learn more at nhpr.org and click support. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Dr. Brian Herdifer of Manchester, providing general and cosmetic dentistry to New Hampshire families, welcoming new patients. Details at bruinsdentist.com. Partly to mostly sunny today, high temperatures mid-20s to lower 30s. It'll be partly to mostly cloudy tonight, overnight lows in the teens. For tomorrow, partly to mostly cloudy, high temperatures lower 30s. Partly sunny day Saturday, high temperatures in the lower 40s. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're following up on a recent Science Cafe discussion in Concord on the science of parenting. Now, if you want to learn more about the Science Cafe, it's a monthly event, meets in Concord and Nashua. You can go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And you can join us now with your questions and comments on the science of parenting. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We have two guests, Jessica Leahy. She writes for many publications, including the New York Times and the Atlantic. She's the author of The Gift of Failure, and she's a teacher in Vermont. KJ Delantonio is also here. She's the writer and author of a parenting blog, former lead editor and writer for the Motherload blog at the New York Times, author of the forthcoming book, How to Be a Happier Parent. You can also join us with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477, or again, the email, exchange@nhpr.org. And KJ and Jessica, let's go to our listeners. Juliana's calling from Bedford. Hi, Juliana. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm a bit nervous, so please forgive me if I don't find my words straight away. I love your show, and I've loved your show, Laura, over the past decade. So thank you for doing what you're doing.
You're welcome, anyway, Juliana.
Anyway, my comment, I was driving and I had to pull over, and it made me smile, your comment about perfect parenting. If there's anything I have learned over the past 16 years, there's no such thing as perfect parenting. I believe that we're figuring it out as we go along, almost. Sometimes it feels like almost on a daily basis.
I would say an hourly basis, Juliana, but yeah. Go ahead. So no perfect
Yes.
parenting.
But I also find that our values as what kind of people we are in the world, honesty, integrity, admitting when I'm wrong, when I made a bad choice, to my kid, that goes a tremendously long way in showing them, in modeling them how to be, not just telling them how they should be. As another thing,
Juliana, I want to pick up on that point that you just made. So thank you so much. And Jessica, go ahead. Some people say never apologize to your kid.
Oh, I'm a huge fan of transparency with kids, especially because one of the best things we can do is model our own positive, adaptive response to our own mistakes. You know, I just want to share with listeners, our kids are onto us. They know we're not perfect. So if we're trying to keep them believing that we're perfect, it's a losing battle. But one of the things that we can do for them is model these behaviors about being brave, being emotionally brave, intellectually brave, facing our own mistakes and responding to them in a positive way instead of denying that we made a mistake. So every time I'm out talking to parents at schools and they want me to explain, you know, the very first thing they could do to make their kids more able to handle failure, I say, just start modeling your own positive response to it and start being more mindful about the way you handle your failures. Do you deny that they ever happened? Do you want to pretend to, you know, they didn't happen so they can go away? Or are you actually showing kids that you can be brave enough to say, you know what, I made a mistake and I learned this new thing and I'm going to try to do better now?
KJ, what do you think?
Well, it's also important to realize that you can make a sea change in your parenting. You can change your mind. You can talk to your kids and you can actually say, you know, we've had this chore wheel and you guys are supposed to do these chores every week and you don't do these chores. And we really need, you know, I need your help. So we're gonna come up with a better way to do this. And, you know, then you can invite your kids to contribute in a way, or you can just say, and this is our new way, and this is what we're gonna do. And that you're the parent, you're allowed to say, this hasn't been going the way it needs to, and now we're going to change. Then, you know, you're gonna get some blowback, but so what?
Juliana talked about there's no such thing as perfect parenting, and I'm sure both of you would agree. I wonder what you think, though, KJ, that does this idea of saying there's a science and there's good research, does that kind of up the pressure to find the best science, read the best research, and then maybe you can become perfect? You know, in a way, maybe if you ignored all the good research and good studies and just said, I'm going by my gut here, maybe you'd be less stressed out. I wonder what you think.
You might be less stressed out. There is good research, and it is informative. And you can get, especially, you know, your kids are constantly changing. They're growing. They're learning new things. They're becoming capable of new things. But we as parents, you know, we're not at that point in our lives. So one of the great things about paying attention to the reading, to the research and reading different books is that it can sort of spark a reminder in you, oh, you know, I've never asked my kid to do her own laundry, but she's probably, I'm sort of stuck on the chores thing at the moment, but she's probably capable of it. Or, oh, I've been sitting down with my kid every night to help with their math, and that's probably not the point of this homework. And then you can make a change in yourself because you're reading. So yes, I do think it can amp up your level of pressure, but there's something to be said for that. We are doing something important here.
So the pressure to be perfect, take the research, look at it, see if it applies to you or not. And maybe it does sort of ping, sets off that little light of, gee, maybe I shouldn't be doing Johnny's science project. That's
right.
Not
and
a good idea.
And also, I mean, to read it all with that awareness, as Juliana said, that you're not going to be perfect. You don't have to get this right the first time or every time to still do a great and wonderful job. You've got a long period of time here to work within.
Here's an email that kind of gets to this point that we've been talking about. This is from Allison. She says, one thing that has really bothered and concerned me is the shaming/guilt that parents seem to feel if they aren't following the newest recommendations on screen time, sunscreen, diets, etc. Allison says, it seems that parenting has become a competitive sport, which is obviously unfair. Allison says, we all know that there is not one right way to parent because every family and every child are different. So, Allison, thank you so much. What do you think, Jessica?
That's funny you say that. I actually got an email this morning. I was doing a speaking engagement somewhere, and I got an email from someone saying that the population at this school that I really need to come to talk about the gift of failure is so intense that they're so competitive about everything that she wouldn't be surprised if they're being competitive about the fact that their kid is going to fail the most. So
I don't think that's the point.
it is an incredibly competitive competitive thing right now, parenting is. And one of the things that we do know that there's this wonderful research by this woman named Wendy Grolnick, and she looks at the way we as parents feed that, and we encourage each other's craziness by talking to each other about all of the fantastic, amazing things we're doing for our children. And we start to, you know, kind of hyperventilate a little bit. I got to write a piece for The Atlantic called Why Back to School Night Made Me Feel Like a Bad Parent, because I was feeling great about my kids when I left the house. They were, you know, playing Minecraft and practicing guitar. And by the time back to school night was over, I was practically hyperventilating because I'm not doing the tutoring and the cello lessons and the independent string league and the traveling soccer league. And I had to kind of step away and say, no, your kids are okay. This is not a competition. But even if I can get caught up in that, if the person who wrote the book, The Gift of Failure, can get caught up in the competitive parenting thing, I think just about anyone is sort of vulnerable to that.
We talked earlier about the neuroscience, how it's been emerging and evolving. We do know so much more about how the brain develops and so forth. And I wanted to ask you, Jessica, about the adolescent brain. Mm-hmm. We did a whole show on this not that long ago with a wonderful scientist who told us that the brain actually isn't fully developed until age 25. He said adolescence goes from age 10 to 25. I'm still wrapping my head around that one, and that show was a while ago. So what does that mean for parenting teenagers and young adults?
I think it can be the most fun part of parenting these highly problematic creatures. As someone who has spent a lot of time teaching, almost 20 years teaching teenagers, I love them because they're these works in progress. And remembering that, for example, you know, their frontal lobe, the front part of their brain, which is where all of that executive function, that like time management and planning and dealing with all of their materials at school and managing a schedule and their books and keeping their pants up and keeping their shoes tied, all of that stuff is part of executive function. And that's the frontal lobe where all that resides is the last part of the brain to develop. So when you say that adolescent goes up through 25, that's absolutely correct. But remembering that we're not talking about – they're not 12 until they're 25. They're, you know, they're evolving. Their brains are growing. And the frontal lobe's not done until then. But the fun part about teaching and parenting teenagers is that you get to see this evolution happen. You know, this kid who 6 months ago couldn't get up and out of the house in the morning by themselves is suddenly setting an alarm and getting out of the house by themselves. And then it's really important to remember that 3 months later, maybe they've forgotten how to get themselves out of the house in the morning at this, you know, and remembering that, you know, childhood development is not this beautiful linear slope that's constantly improving every single day. Having, you know, I have KJ to remind me sometimes that, yeah, you're really feeling hopeless today because your kid is for some reason an idiot today and can't remember how to do their laundry. Remember where they were 6 months ago or a year ago. Remember that, you know, parenting is this nice long haul progress. We have to keep our eye on the future and where we want our kids to be in 6 months or a year. And that's patience. That's where the magic sauce is with teenagers. Patience, patience, patience.
Well, and on the science that tells us what you talked about, that this frontal lobe develops the last, sometimes this research, Jessica, feels like letting teens and young adults off the hook for their behavior because their brains aren't fully formed.
Oh, believe me, I do not let teenagers off the hook. I think it's really important to hold them. I think it's important for parents to remember that we are not there to tell them how to do everything. We're not there to take over and do for them. We are there to be their training wheels, their executive function training wheels. We're there to support. There's a lot of research to show that when parents are supportive of kids' autonomy, they can be not only more motivated in the long term to sort of learn for the sake of learning itself, but also better learners. When we do too much for kids, especially at a young age, we train them to become, we teach them helplessness. We teach them that they're not competent. And so it's, I think over time, it's really important as they get older, as it's appropriate, to step back a little and give your kid the time to think about, to be frustrated. Number one, it's so important to let kids be frustrated. It's so important to give kids a moment to work things out for themselves rather than you jump in and fix it for them.
So this is a scientific case against helicopter parenting.
Yes, this is all the work of Wendy Grolnick. She did this beautiful work on autonomy, supportive parenting versus directive parenting. Kids of directive parents are less able to sort of be frustrated and complete tasks on their own. And kids who can't be frustrated, those are a teaching nightmare for me. Kids who fall apart at the slightest hint of frustration, they're less teachable in my classroom. So give kids a chance to be frustrated.
KJ, go ahead.
So rather than using this neuroscientific research to let kids off the hook, what it can do for us is help us let ourselves off the hook. So the fact that I have to remind my kid to put his dish in the dishwasher every single time for six solid years is not a failure on my part. It's not a failure on his part. It's just a thing. It's just a brain. You know, he's just not come together in, you know, my scientific diagram of how to put a coat on a hook, which I've displayed many times.
You have a scientific diagram of how to put a coat on a
hook. I have created that. I can give you a lovely sarcastic
lesson. I smell a little sarcasm. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. But we can just take that for ourselves and accept that, okay, I'm going to be reminding you. I'm going to be, you know, coat, hook. I'm going to be picking up the coat. I'm going to be dropping it on your head. You know, but you can do that without anger when you're aware that the kid's not doing this to make you angry. You know, they're not doing this on purpose and they're not doing it because you failed. They're just doing it.
So that's how the science helps. Yeah, go ahead, Jessica.
It can be a lot of fun, too. I mean, at times, I think it's going to be, parenting can be so hard. It's going to be important to, like, look for the fun moments. And one of the things we did at my house that actually ended up in a lot of laughter is someone told me that you can use dry erase markers on your appliances, like a white sort of washer and dryer, and you can write the instructions for how to do laundry on the washing machine. I actually wrote, it was one of the most fun days I've had in a long time. It was a blog post I wrote called Special Care Instructions at JessicaLeahy.com. And all over the washing machine, I like circled buttons and said, wait, is there dog poop on that? Go get that spray bottle over there on the table and spray something on there. Wait, is it a nice day outside? Consider using the clothesline, that kind of thing. And that was funny. I mean, I know for a fact that my kid smiles when he goes down in the basement sometimes because I put jokes on there. I put all kinds of, because I know that just because a kid knew how to do a laundry 2 weeks ago does not mean he's going to remember how to do it in another 2 weeks. So just make that part of your existence. To have some patience for that.
I like the idea of scribbling on the appliances, too.
It's really fun.
You can send us an email if you'd like. We're talking about the science of parenting. What we know, what we don't know, what's valid, what's opinion. You can join us. Send us an email. exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. By the way, we have links on our website to both of your blogs, as well as information about the Science Cafe. Well, one more question about brain science, and this is for you, KJ. Another area that I know neuroscientists are looking at is the distracted brain, is the tech-addicted brain, if I could call it that, is the brain that never has a chance to rest, to stare into space. I'm talking about modern children. So what do we know here?
We know that all of our brains, not just children's brains, we know that our brains love the feedback loop that is created by lots of apps, by Facebook, by social media. And we also know that our brains are never quiet, that there's this, that we have our own constant internal feedback loops. And what's great about learning that as a parent is both that you can use it yourself. You know, you can hopefully learn to quiet your own mind or suddenly realize that urge to pick up your phone and interact with it is, it's not necessarily really your urge. It's like an urge created by previous interactions. And having tried to do that yourself, you can offer that to your kids. Because one of the important things that I think we miss about screen time in kids, especially when they're young, is that on the one hand, we're creating limits for them. We're usually setting a limit and making them adhere to it. But the long-term goal is that they learn to manage this stuff themselves because, you know, they're not going to leave their phone behind when they head off for college, but they're not going to have you there showing them the whole time, you know, how to limit themselves. So Jess was talking earlier about teaching kids to set their own limits. And that's your goal when it comes to tech and understanding the mind's interaction with tech, is not to apply it to their lives, but to show them how to apply it to their own lives.
What do we know about the impact of the brain of it always, especially the kid brain, of always being busy? And what sort of antidotes does science tell us might counter that?
Well, I mean, I can look at that from a couple of different angles. But one, when you say always being busy, something that makes me think about is the fact that it's not just a question of tech. We are typically, as families nowadays, we do a lot. Every afternoon is often scheduled, whether you're a full-time, you know, if both parents work full-time, the kids are often going straight into daycare or straight to everyday afternoon activities. Then they're getting grabbed by the parents. Maybe they're going off to their Suzuki Music before they head home. We're very busy, so that's got an effect on kids' brains, and you know, we need to look at that.
All right. Well, coming up, I'll let you talk about that a little bit more. A couple emails coming in as well. People want to ask you about the science of parenting. What's real? What isn't? You can join us. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477.
know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work? Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster, and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're following up on a Science Cafe conversation in Concord this week on the research and science around parenting. The Science Cafe is a monthly forum held in Concord and Nashua by Granite Geek David Brooks of the Concord Monitor. You can find out more information on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. You can send us an email right now, exchange@nhpr.org, with your thoughts, questions, comments, critiques about this concept of the science of parenting, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And KJ Delantonia, Jessica Leahy, lots of people jumping in, so let's go to them. Here's someone who didn't want to leave a name. This person says, what do you have to say about keeping kids accountable when they have made decisions that have been harmful to themselves, such as using cutting to deal with stress? Oh, my goodness. My heart goes out to you. I have heard of kids doing this, and it's heartbreaking for parents and terrifying. Jessica, can I throw this to you, since this probably is more of a teenage behavior and you work with teens, sometimes troubled teens?
I actually got to write, KJ used to be my editor at the New York Times, and I got to write a whole piece about cutting and self-injurious behavior. And I think one of the things, when it comes to kids who have high anxiety, special needs, they're really suffering. And there was a lot of talk at the Science Cafe the other day about sort of heightened anxiety among kids these days. I think one of the problems is that parents tend to feel really bad. We don't want our children to feel bad. We don't want our children to suffer. And so one of the things that can happen is that we then will step in and do a lot more for our children because we want to take some of that burden off of them. And I cited one of my favorite therapists that's out there working with kids a lot, especially anxious kids, is Katie Hurley. And Katie Hurley, I quoted her in an article where she said, you know, for kids that are newly diagnosed with learning issues or kids that have some issue that makes life more complicated for them, our initial impulse to take over all of their stuff and help them constantly with all of their stuff can actually feed a problem called learned helplessness, which is the more we do for our children, the more we sort of convey that idea that we see them as not competent, the more we set them up to be increasingly incompetent and to not believe that they have the ability to solve problems for themselves. So while I definitely think the kids who have, you know, anxiety or issues with cutting need help, please get professional help, because self-injurious behavior is incredibly dangerous. That you also need to balance that with the fact that these are still developing kids who need to feel like they can have an impact in the world and have an impact in their own lives of solving their own problems. So we need to balance helping our children with not over-helping our children and making them feel helpless, because learned helplessness is a real thing.
Do you want to jump in on that, KJ?
I feel like that emailer had really two separate things going on there, because there's a question of holding kids accountable for bad decisions, but cutting isn't a bad decision.
Thank you.
It's cutting a cry for help.
Right. Cutting is a sign that you don't know how to handle something. So I think when it comes to a bad decision is driving home drunk after a party and getting caught. And when it comes to something like that, it is actually important to help your kid minimize the consequences as best as you can without leaping in and calling up your buddy, the police chief, and trying to fix things for them. So that's sort of one kind of bad decision where you want to fall on the side of helping the child but not protecting them. When it comes to something like cutting, I think protecting is probably your number one. Bad decisions don't even necessarily come into it.
Ms. Parent, thank you for the email, and best of luck to you. Here's an email from Jessica in Keene, who says, sitting here at work listening to you guys, find it very interesting. I have a 6-year-old stepdaughter. She has some attention issues, which is causing her to fall behind a little in school. She's a social butterfly. She loves school but struggles to stay focused, tries to rush through her work. What can we do to help her stay focused in the classroom and at home? It's so easy to get frustrated, but we know it isn't her fault. We just need to approach it differently. I think one of you wrote about this recently, about kids with learning issues and how much, again, you hold them accountable and how much you say, okay, you've got a learning issue. We keep getting back to this, don't we? Yeah.
It's a challenge, especially at six, to know what's a learning issue and what's just being six. You keep in mind that our expectations for kids for sitting still and learning and doing homework have ramped up dramatically in the past few years. And if you turn to Scandinavian countries and look at their educational systems, which I think we all get a little tired of holding them up as examples, but they don't even necessarily expect a kid to learn to read until second or third grade.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. I mean, a six-year-old who's more focused on her classmates than her schoolwork, you know, you want to hesitate before you call that a problem, because that just sounds like being six.
Well, and that's interesting that you say that. And we've done a gazillion shows on this, too, over the years, KJ. The idea that there is a pharmaceutical industry that is interested mm-hmm. in selling you medications that maybe by 10 or 12 you determine that your kid needs
right,
you know, and HDD medications, but at six, maybe
yeah.
not.
There are teachers in schools, and this is more common with boys than girls, that really encourage, you know, they ask you, well, your child is disruptive because they're not fitting into the model that we have for the way that kids easily behave in our large classroom. And so there can be a real pressure to get a diagnosis and get things sorted out, but that is often not what might help you now may not be what you want in the long run. So you really need to look ahead and go, you know, I think we can talk to our daughter about her behavior. We can encourage her to enjoy her friends, but also to try to find ways to sit down without necessarily bowing to this idea that if she doesn't fit the mold, there's something wrong with her.
What has the science, again, getting back to our theme of the science of parenting, what has the science told us over the years about a lot of the medications that kids these days take, from, you know, antidepressants at a young age, from medications to control behavior, so to speak. You know, some people swear by them. They're really helpful. But children today do take a lot more medications than they did when we were growing up.
I actually would love to back up a tiny bit and talk about the fact that one of the things we do know is that we are some of the rates of kids with things like ADHD or ADD or Asperger's are the numbers are exploding for a number of different reasons. One of them being that we're just better at detecting it. Another is that this is something I hear a lot from school counselors. When I'm in schools talking to counselors, they say one of the issues that they're facing a lot these days, and I definitely don't want to downplay the fact that there are kids dealing with these very, very real issues, that there's so much competition in schools that parents are really eager to look for a way that their kids can have a step up. And so one of the things that I'm hearing from counselors across the country is that parents are really pushing for testing to get their kids labeled with some sort of disorder so that they can get more time on tests and things like that. And again, many, many children need more time on tests. Many, many children need medications. I just want to make it really, really clear that the problem is that we have a really limited, we have limited resources when it comes to kids who need extra help and extra time and extra resources in schools. And so I would love to encourage parents to think that many of the things that we're now calling a disorder are actually within the realm of normal, and that maybe it's just a time to watch your kids grow a little bit.
Yeah. And when it comes to this idea of whether or not your kid might need medication to help them to focus, which is one of the more common things that we're dealing with right now, you really want to look at whether or not that's a lot of that in the classroom, whether the school is really sort of pushing or encouraging that, whether you're in a community or have doctors that are doing a lot of it, while you consider whether or not that's what your kid really needs.
Well, Jess, thank you for the email and a topic for a whole show. We've done those programs before, but maybe it's time to do it again. So good luck to you. Thank you for the email. Let's go back to the phone. Sue is in Northwood. Hi, Sue. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say that I had studied child development more than 50 years ago at the University of New Hampshire, and two things I got out of it that guided my child rearing that I think still are overarching things. One was that if you love your children and they know you love them, you can make a lot of mistakes and they won't have too much trouble, much effect, because the kids know you were you love them and you were doing your best. And the other thing is that you need to tend to your marriage, that a good, strong marriage is the best predictor of good outcomes with child rearing of anything.
Thank you so much, Sue. And I'm so glad she called because I did have a question for the both of you. You know, parenting approaches change, science evolves, philosophies change over the decades. What is enduring in terms of the science of parenting or just good research about parenting? What do you think, KJ? What's sort of timeless? And I love that you called, Sue.
One of the things that's timeless is exactly what Sue said, that parents who are loving and invested and spending a lot of time with their kids, even if they're spending a lot of time with your kids watching TV is still spending a lot of time with your kids. So people that have that loving, solid relationship, those tend to be kids that, you know, that are able to be resilient and bounce back from the challenges of life. So that is, you know, that's a really an enduring and important piece.
What do you think, Jessica?
I love there's a tenet in teaching that sometimes what teachers need to do is, and there's actually research behind this as well, that sometimes if we overestimate by just a hair what our children can do, that our children will rise to the challenge. And that often parents can underestimate what their kids are capable of just a little bit. So as a parent and as a teacher, I think it's a great idea to sort of meet your child where they are. That's one of the most important tenets of education as well. Meet your child where they are and then push your expectations for them just a little bit higher.
Doing laundry isn't that hard, especially when mom takes the Sharpie,
exactly.
Or not the Sharpie, the erasable marker and writes all over the washing machine.
And it's also important for us as parents to take care of ourselves.
Yes.
You can, if you have a strong relationship or a partner, then definitely tend to that. And also just tend to your own strengths and your own happiness. One thing that is enduringly true in terms of, and this is mostly self-reported, but it's that parents who are feeling confident and successful in their parenting, and that doesn't mean your kids are doing awesome. It means you feel good about who you are and your relationship with your kids. Those are parents of more successful kids and also just a more successful and happy family relationship.
Well, Sue, thank you so much for the call. And here's an email from Tara that I definitely want to share with you. Tara says, I know there's a lot of research showing brains develop later than we thought, but I often wonder how our modern life and methods of parenting are changing how the brain develops. I read about the responsibilities that children had in previous generations and wonder if we scan their brains, if we would see significant differences in how quickly they mature. Tara says, has anyone studied the brains of children in cultures that require early responsibility and seen whether there is a difference? I can't help but think that our brains have not always developed as slowly as they do today. Tara, wow, I love this email. And I had a moment like this yesterday. One of my kids was asking me to do something that he was perfectly capable of doing, throwing a fit about it. And I thought, wow, kids your age used to, you know, get on a ship from some war-torn country in Europe, right? And,
right.
You know, you read about these teenagers who got on these boats, came to New York City, had no prospects, had no money, found a job in the garment district, you know, and then ended up running a successful business. And here's this person asking me to do something ridiculous. So I had the same thought you did, Tara. Thank you so much.
I don't know that that has a lot to do about brain development. I think that just has to do about expectations and
problem solving. Okay, so if you could scan that young immigrant brain, to use my example, would it be different?
Well, I don't think anybody has done brain scans, but there is some really exciting anthropological research comparing modern, it's actually sort of goes back to the 90s, but comparing Los Angeles parents to like Peruvian parents and looking at what their kids do and what their expectations are. And you definitely see kids whose society places a much higher expectation on them, they do step up and they reach, you know, they behave in more mature ways more quickly. Now, whether you see the decision making, you know, improving or the brain function improving, I don't think anybody's brought that MRI to the Amazon.
Yeah.
But it is interesting stuff.
You can't go back in time and look at, you know, look at the things that, you know,
and you can't listen to us all saying, well, when I was a kid,
Oh, now wait a second.
No. This is anecdotal and highly, highly unscientific.
Well, thank you so much for that email, Tara. And a couple listeners have sent in their favorite parenting books. We talked earlier about how there are shelves and shelves and shelves of these and how you sort of sort out what's useful and what isn't. A Facebook comment from Adam, who recommends a book called Baby, Owner's Manual. He says, hands down, best parenting book I ever got. Clear, direct diagrams dispensed with unnecessary fluff. A lot of discussion about spiritual bonds can't replace the value of a step-by-step troubleshooting guide for a screaming infant. Wow, Adam, I wish I had that one. Because I certainly needed it. Here's one from Kathy in Keene. She talks about the expectations of kindergarten, seat time, high-stakes education. And she says parents and children who learn differently, who are simply not ready for competitive reading and math, slow things down. Kathy says Big Little Lies is a great book and a well-done movie focused on helicopter parents. That's a novel. It's not a parenting book. But I have read it, and she's absolutely right.
She is right.
So thank
Actually,
you, Kathy,
reading,
for that
one.
One
of my favorite books about reading, Dan Willingham, is a fantastic resource on early reading in kids and what not to worry about when teaching kids to read. He's speaking of highly scientific. His research is highly scientific, and he's a fantastic writer.
So there are so many books out there. We started talking about this, so let's end there. What are some of your favorites, KJ?
My probably favorite book about the day-to-day what to actually do when your kids do thing has got to be, and it's an old one, it's a classic, How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen to Kids So Kids Will Talk, and it's sister book, Sibling Rivalry, because they're based on anecdotal research, but it's a lot of anecdotal research, and then they give you actual things to say and do when kids do some typical stuff. So that's great. But on a more sciencey based note, I've got I love this book called The Informed Parent, a science-based resource for your child's first 4 years. It's by Tara Heil and Emily Willingham. I think no relation to Dan. And it's just, you know, there's better science when kids are little than there is when they're big, but this is really useful on labor, birth,
it's
sleep.
A great book.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Favorites definitely come down to, for resilience, Kenneth Ginsberg's work with the American Academy of Pediatrics on resilience.
Agreed.
I love Michelle Borba's work on empathy and the impact that social emotional learning and empathy can have on sort of the whole child. And I have to give another shout out to Lawrence Steinberg on teens. Lawrence Steinberg is the man when it comes to teens. You and Your Adolescent and Age of Opportunity are two of my favorite books about teens.
Okay. Well, I think we'll put the names of those books on our website. So if you're driving down the highway and you can't write those down, exchange at nhpr.org. Check it out there. Excuse me, NHPR Exchange. And we'll put the names of those books up there on our website. Also, both of you have books. Again, KJ Delantonia, forthcoming book is How to Be a Happier Parent. So we'll look forward to that. And Jessica Leahy has The Gift of Failure, about the benefits of allowing children to make mistakes. Both of you, this has been so fun. Thank you so much for being here. Great
Thank
to
you.
See you.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.